Let me tell you about the online cannabis company that's revolutionizing how we deal with life's challenges, from sleepless nights to stress-filled days. Mood.com has created an entire line of functional gummies that target specific health concerns with 100% federally legal THC blends that they'll deliver discreetly right to your doorstep. And you can get 20% off your first order at Mood.com with promo code ATTWG. It is wild how different each one of their gummies feels. Their sleepy time gummies knock me out in about 15 minutes flat with no hangovers, no grogginess, and I just wake up feeling amazing. Oh, and the Epic Euphoria gummies, they're perfect for those days when nothing's going right and you just need to hit the reset button on your crap mood. What makes these different is how they pair THC and other cannabinoids with herbs and adaptogens. You're not gonna just find gummies like this in a dispensary, or anywhere for that matter. And they have gummies for literally everything. Immune support, menopause relief, PMS symptoms, mental clarity, and sexual arousal. And each one is crafted using federally legal cannabis grown on small, family-owned American farms. No pesticides, no BS, and they can ship to most states in the U.S. Best of all, not only does Mood stand behind everything with an industry-leading 100-day satisfaction guarantee, but, as I mentioned, listeners get 20% off their first order with code ATTWG. So head to Mood.com, browse their amazing selection of functional gummies, and find the perfect gummy for whatever you're dealing with. And remember to use promo code ATTWG at checkout to save 20% on your first order. With Mother's Day around the corner, are you thinking about a truly special gift for your mom? Let me tell you about MyLifeInABook.com. It's a unique service that turns your mom's life stories into a beautiful book. Here's how it works. Every week, MyLifeInABook.com will send her a question via email. These can be pre-written questions about her life or any custom questions that you wish to ask. And then she can either type a response or use their voice-to-text feature, and MyLifeInABook.com compiles all of her responses into a beautiful keepsake book. And guess what? They can even create an audiobook using her voice recordings. It's like preserving her voice and stories for eternity. Imagine discovering stories about her youth, adventures, and the challenges she overcame. This book becomes a legacy. It's something that you and future generations can treasure forever. Your mom's given you a lifetime of stories. This is your chance to give her a way to share them. And this is something that Ethan and I had been thinking about doing with our parents. We have this podcasting equipment, so we wanted to find a way for them to tell their story. But I love this because it's so regimented. They send them a question every week, and it just makes it really easy and turnkey. And it just seems like a great way for us to get our parents' stories down so that our children and our children's children can have them. So if you're interested, check out MyLifeInABook.com and use code ATTWG at checkout for 15% off. Create an unforgettable gift for your mom this Mother's Day. That's MyLifeInABook.com and use code ATTWG for 15% off today. Has it ever felt like you're doing everything right? You're eating healthy, you're working out, and yet your energy still crashes, or your mood swings hit out of nowhere, like a twist in a crime story that you didn't see coming. Listen, I've been there too, and what I've discovered is that many of these issues could be tied to hormonal imbalances, like a hidden criminal lurking in the background, throwing everything off track. But here's the good news. This is one mystery that you can solve with Happy Mammoth. There's no need for a long investigation. Just take the free 2-minute quiz from Happy Mammoth. You answer a few questions about what you're experiencing and where you're at in life, and you'll uncover the real culprit behind your hormonal symptoms. And the best part? After taking the quiz, you'll get a personalized recommendation to help you balance your hormones so you can finally feel like yourself again. According to a survey, after taking Hormone Harmony, 86% of women started to lose weight. 77% said that it improved their mood. And the biggest benefit? 100% of women surveyed said they're feeling like themselves again. For a limited time, you can get 15% off your entire first order at happymammoth.com. Just use the code ATTWG at checkout. That's happymammoth.com and use the code ATTWG for 15% off today. I'm taking away your electronics. It's a sentence that strikes fear into the heart of children and teenagers all over the world, and one that I would say most parents have uttered on multiple occasions. On August 31st, 2015, those words were directed at 17-year-old Mason Smith. The high schooler loved video games and anime, often to the detriment of his schoolwork and other responsibilities. While taking away a teenager's electronics often leads to some muttered, snarky response or slammed door, in Mason's case, it was the last straw. By the next day, September 1st, he was gone. Now, over 5 years later, Mason's family still doesn't know where he is, and questions remain. Did he simply walk out of his life, or did he succumb to a more tragic fate, either by his own hand or someone else's? When a person goes missing, there's a special kind of pain in the not knowing. I want to tell the stories of those who never came home. I want to tell you the story of Mason Smith. I'm Kona Gallagher.
And I'm Ethan Flick.
And this is And Then They Were Gone. Okay, so you already looked at me when I said the, you know, taking away the electronics line.
Well, it's every single day we say it in this house.
Yeah.
Every day.
I mean, okay, we don't actually take away their electronics every day, but we definitely threaten it.
Yeah, we say it every day.
They have to really be bad in order to get it taken away, but it's such a struggle.
Yeah.
You know, between parents and kids and especially now with COVID, because that's kind of their only lifeline outside of our house.
Yeah.
In a lot of ways. So it is tougher, I think, to take that away from them than it was before. But, you know, again, it's just this universal parental experience nowadays.
The threat works sometimes, though.
Yeah. Let's go ahead and talk about Mason. Mason Darren Smith was born on April 7th, 1998, to Tracy and Darren Smith. Although he was born in American Fork, Utah, Mason spent the majority of his childhood in Alberta, Canada. The youngest of six children, Mason was definitely the baby of the family and was coddled by his older siblings. Though his father, Darren, is agnostic, Mason's mother was Mormon, and she raised the children in the LDS Church. As a toddler, Mason was diagnosed with a speech delay, but with speech therapy, the issue eventually resolved itself, but it did leave him with a slight speech impediment. Perhaps it was the speech delay or the impediment or just being the youngest of six children and not being able to get a word in edgewise, but Mason was a quiet, sensitive child who tended to spend time alone. But as he grew older, he, you know, became a typical teenager. He loved playing video games. And like I mentioned at the beginning, he really got into anime. And this is pretty normal behavior, but it did seem to interfere with his schoolwork to a degree. So it became a point of contention between Mason and his parents. In December of 2013, when Mason was 15, this whole point of contention with the, you know, the video games and the electronics came to a head when his father, Darren, confiscated Mason's Xbox.
Uh-oh.
Yeah, I know. For Mason, that was the straw that broke the camel's back. He decided that he was tired of his parents' rules and not being able to do what he wanted to do. So he packed a bag with clothes, food, a sleeping bag, and a stack of resumes.
Whoa.
I know, right?
Like, all right.
Yeah.
He's thinking long term here.
Exactly. And he ran away from home, determined to make it on his own. But, you know, there were several problems with this plan.
15.
That was the major one. Yeah. Yes. Also, it was December in Alberta, Canada.
A little chilly.
A little chilly. Yeah. As it turns out. So he quickly headed back home, his dreams of independence dashed. Hmm. Even though he quickly came back home, tensions between Mason and his parents continued, and he seemed to withdraw even more. Things got so bad with the teenager that in September of 2014, so a little less than a year after the running away, he was actually hospitalized for a week because of a suicide attempt.
Oh, Jesus.
Yeah. And what's interesting to me is that not long after this hospitalization, the Smith family made a huge change. In April of 2015, the same month that Mason turned 17, and just over 6 months after this hospitalization, the family moved from Alberta, Canada, to St. George, Utah. And it's a little unclear, like, as to why they moved. I've read some things about how Mason's mom, Tracy, had a job, a really good job opportunity there. And that also, I did read that, like, they were hoping that a fresh start mm-hmm. might help him out.
So they moved from Utah to Canada and then now back to Utah.
Back to Utah. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. So I don't know. I mean, I really hope that part of the reason was to help Mason, because at that point he was the youngest of six, and mm-hmm. he was the only child in the house. And so, like, for him to move right before his senior year of high school, I mean,
yeah, that would be tough.
That's tough, yeah. Right?
But maybe there's more family support there.
Yeah.
If they're from Utah originally.
Exactly. And so, like, I'm hoping that that was kind of the reasoning behind it. Cause that, I mean, that seems like a lot of upheaval in a kid's life. And what's interesting about this time, though, is that Mason's father wasn't really around. And I couldn't find exactly what he did for a living, but he worked out of town for that entire spring and summer. Mm. So I don't know if it was a situation where, like, Tracy got a job in Utah, but Darren kept his job in Canada, and, like, just didn't move to Utah with the rest of the family and then came later, or if he has, like, some sort of, you know, seasonal type job or what it was. But in any case, when they moved to Utah in April, it was pretty much just Mason and Tracy. Darren actually returned home into the house in Utah on August 29th, 2015. So whatever routine Mason and his mom had kind of gotten into, you know, it definitely changed in some regard when his dad came back. In fact, father and son seemed to butt heads almost immediately. So remember, you know, when I said that a lot of the issues that Mason's parents had around him watching anime and playing video games centered around it interfering with his schoolwork?
Mm-hmm.
Well, so that didn't actually seem to be the case at this point. On August 31st, Mason texted his mom and asked her if his grades were good enough to watch anime. And he, like, sent her, you know, a screenshot or whatever of what his current grades were. And he was getting straight A's.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Wow. And granted, you know, this is, like, the very beginning of the school year or whatever. But still,
but still,
I mean, you know, he was getting A's. Like, he was doing what he needed to do. And I looked at his classes and, like, he was taking some difficult looking classes there. So, you know, so his mom was like, oh, yeah, no, great job. You're doing awesome. Like, yeah, you can, you know, you can go ahead and play video games and stuff, but your dad wants to give you a driving lesson first. So do that and then you're good. But when Darren got home and, you know, tried to take Mason on the driving lesson, Mason told him that he had a headache and he wasn't feeling well and didn't want to go.
Right. Because he wanted to play video games.
Right. Yeah. And we get that
with our kids constantly. I mean, not with driving lessons. We're not there yet. But like, definitely if it's like, hey, you can play video games, but do this thing first. Like, they will do anything to get out of whatever the first thing is.
Well, yeah. Even the 3-year-old, when he doesn't want to do something, he says, I'm sick.
Yeah, he does. He does. He says, my belly hurts.
Yeah.
My belly hurts about that.
So we're a little familiar with this routine.
Yeah, exactly. So he doesn't go on the driving lesson. And when Tracy returned home from work around 8:30 that night, she found Mason in his room with the lights off. She asked him what was wrong, and he said that he just didn't feel well. But, you know, so she let him be, and he continued watching anime and doing his thing. At 10, though, she turned off the internet in the house, which is such a good move. And I've like, I know a lot of parents just do that.
Yeah.
And it's kind of like, it's kind of cool. They're just like, yeah, no, the internet's gone.
Maybe we should do that.
I know. But, you know, it apparently didn't stop Mason because Darren woke up around 1:30 in the morning and, like, apparently Mason was still up and still on his computer. Mm-hmm. And this annoyed Darren, as you can imagine. So he confiscated Mason's laptop and cell phone.
Wow.
Yeah. I mean, because, you know, it's 1:30 in the morning and he's like, no, enough. It's a school night.
Yeah.
Like, he wasn't having it, so he took it. And, you know, according to both parents, like, Mason willingly gave up the electronics. They didn't have a big fight about it or whatever. You know, Darren just took the stuff and left, and Mason presumably went to bed. The next day, September 1st, started off normally. Darren knocked on Mason's door a little after 7 to make sure that he was, like, up and getting ready for school. But, you know, he was 17, so, like... He was responsible for getting himself off to school for the most part. You know, they weren't getting him dressed and making him breakfast and stuff like that. So Darren knocked on the door, made sure he was alive. And then, like, you know, he went back
to bed. Went on about his business.
Yeah. Yeah. No. Yeah. Darren just went back to bed. He was just like, all right, bye. Cause you know, he wasn't like working at this time.
Yeah.
So he didn't have anywhere he really needed to be. So his parents stayed upstairs, but they said that they heard him in the kitchen, you know, rummaging around for food. And then they heard the garage door open and close at 7:40 when it was time for him to leave to go catch the bus. Tracy went to work as normal that day, not realizing that anything was wrong. And, you know, Darren went to the gym. Mm-hmm. But at 3:15 that afternoon, Mason's bus arrived, but Mason wasn't on it. So Darren called Tracy at work to let her know that their son didn't come home. So, you know, at first she's like, okay, like, that's weird. But again, he's 17, so it's not the most insane thing that's ever happened.
Sure, yeah.
But while she's at work still, she gets an email from the school saying that Mason was absent that day.
Mm. So he left 7:40 in the morning and never showed up to school.
Right. Mm. So now at this point, she's like, okay, this is a bigger deal than him, you know, hanging out with friends or missing the bus or not coming home right away or whatever it was that she was thinking was going on. Cause, you know, but at this point, she's like, honestly, probably just more mad than scared.
Was there a history of him skipping school?
Not that,
that you know of?
No, not that I know of. I never saw anything about that. But I mean, I have to imagine that's like what she was thinking at first.
Yeah.
So after that, you know, Tracy leaves work and she and Darren kind of start looking around for Mason. But like, again, not panicking yet. They went to the places where he likes to hang out, including, I guess, he would go to a youth group at their church a lot. So they went there, see if he was just hanging out there or, you know, whatever. But nobody had seen him and they didn't find any trace of him. They're also probably kicking themselves at this point because they can't contact Mason.
Because dad has his cell phone.
Right.
Yeah.
So yeah, that one backfired a little bit. And, you know, the phone was still in the house, as was the laptop. So it's not like Mason came back and got any of that or anything. As day turns into night, the Smiths start to get more and more worried, and they ended up calling the sheriff's department and filing a missing persons report. A deputy on patrol says that he'll keep an eye out, but, you know, no trace of Mason was found.
Well, yeah, I mean, Mason has at least an 8-hour head start, probably longer than that
right.
at this point. So who's to say he's actually in town if he is, you know, if he ran away.
Yeah. And I think like, and that's the thing. I mean, they don't at this point know when he left, really. You know, they know that he left the house at like 7:40, but then they both left. And so they don't know if he came back at any point. They don't know if he got on the bus or if he never got on the bus.
Yeah, so I was just going to ask, do we know, did the police ever interview the bus driver, find out if Mason made it
Tracy
on the bus?
So Tracy did. Okay. So the next day when, you know, Mason's still not home, that's when she's like, okay, I really need to figure out what's going on here. And she did. She talked to the bus driver. She like called the bus depot or whatever and, you know, found the bus driver. And yeah, she said that Mason never got on the bus.
So when he ran away when he was 15, mm-hmm. You know, did he have a cell phone then? And did he take it with him?
That I don't know. I just remember reading that he took the bag with like clothes and stuff. I'm not sure if he had a cell phone at that point.
Okay.
Right now it's like the next day. Tracy finds out that Mason didn't get on the bus. The police are officially out looking for him. And so they kind of concentrate in the house to see what they can figure out.
Sure,
there,
what clues right? are left behind.
Yeah. Exactly. So they, of course, start going through Mason's room. Mm-hmm. And they immediately found his backpack and all of his school books hidden in his closet.
And the parents didn't see him leave.
No.
So
yeah, they didn't
notice.
They
don't know whether he came back in later after they left mm-hmm. the house.
Yeah.
But yeah. You would also assume if he came back in that he would have grabbed at least his cell phone.
Right. His cell phone, like clothes, like anything. And yeah. It doesn't look like he took anything with him. And what's scary is that there isn't anything missing and there's just stuff there that shouldn't be. Right. And the thing about the backpack and the school books is like, they were hidden in his closet, like under clothes. I mean,
oh yeah, no, he definitely intended to not go to school that day.
Oh, exactly. So whatever
he was hidden from his parents.
Right. And yeah. So whatever he was planning, it was a plan. It wasn't a spontaneous decision.
Do we know, did he have a job? Did he have access to money at this point?
So I don't believe he had a job at that point. I did read that he had worked at Walmart for like 6 months back in Canada, but that was a while ago.
Okay.
But he did have some money, and that actually leads to the next thing that they found. His wallet, complete with cash and a school ID, stuffed in the back of a drawer.
Yeah, that's not a good sign.
Yeah. So at this point, they're kind of thinking that too, because it doesn't appear that Mason has taken anything with him, not his clothes, his backpack, his wallet, or his phone. This is very reminiscent of our last episode mm-hmm. with Robert Hoagie Hoagland.
Yeah.
You know, if you remember in that one, his wife found his wallet hidden underneath a doll in their room 10 days after his disappearance. And he likewise appeared to take nothing with him. But, you know, the main difference here is that Mason's a minor and his parents are terrified.
Yeah.
So at this point, his parents are pretty much thinking that he ran away, that, you know, he was angry with them and he decided to do what he did in Canada and just run away. But he picked an August in Utah instead of a December in Alberta and, you know, was probably like doing a little bit better. That concerned them too, because since the weather was better, like they weren't holding out hope that he was going to come back as quickly as he did last time. They started to mobilize at this point. They alerted Mason's siblings and other family members, and they all kind of came to Utah to put up missing persons flyers and help look for Mason. Tracy also reached out to their church, and the church helped them put search parties together.
And I'm assuming that the police probably questioned some of his friends just to see if maybe that's where he went.
Yeah. I mean, it seems like every part of the investigation into this, like, was your pretty standard missing persons investigation. I mean, you know, this was in 2015. It was over 5 years ago. And his parents still do a lot of interviews. And, you know, they're not like, oh, they never talked to his friends or they never did this. Sure. They never did that. So it seems pretty by the book. And so anyway, when this starts getting going, it seems like their efforts were working because tips started pouring in. One came from a neighbor who knew the family. She said that she was driving in their neighborhood on September 1st, the day that Mason went missing, and saw Mason walking at around 3:15. And it struck, like, it kind of stuck out to her because, you know, that was like before his bus got there. And so it was just a little too early for him to be there.
So he's walking around the neighborhood before he should have been dropped off.
Right. And so that's why it stuck out to her.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, it wasn't like, oh my God, this is something I need to panic about. Then other residents started reporting sightings, including several who said that they saw a boy fitting Mason's description hitchhiking near the exit ramp that leads to Interstate 15 with a sign about needing to go to Las Vegas.
Why Las Vegas, do you think?
Well, they weren't exactly sure, other than like Las Vegas is probably a lot cooler than St. George, Utah. But gas station footage ultimately showed that the hitchhiker wasn't Mason. But that didn't stop Darren. So I'm not exactly clear if like the footage had already shown that this wasn't Mason or not, but either way, Darren and like some other family members went to Vegas. And
worth a shot.
Well, exactly. Right. You know, they thought, okay, Mason's into anime. Vegas has a lot of conventions. Like maybe he was trying to go to some anime convention or something like that. So they went to the strip, and, you know, passed out flyers.
Mm-hmm.
They went there and they were immediately looking for him, but there wasn't any sign of him in Vegas. But on September 7th, 2015, 1 week after her son disappeared, Tracy would make a discovery that would change Darren's thoughts on where Mason had gone and why. Remember how Tracy found Mason's wallet shoved in the back of a drawer in his room?
Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, they looked through it immediately and found his school ID and cash. But I guess on September 7th, they kind of looked a little bit more thoroughly.
Mm-hmm.
And found something else, a note that was folded up very small. The Smiths have declined to make the note public, but they did immediately turn it over to investigators. But based on what Tracy and other family members have said about the note, it sounds pretty heartbreaking. As we talked about earlier, Mason had been battling depression for several years at that point, even attempting suicide back in Canada. While things had initially started to look better after the family moved to Utah, Tracy says that she felt that Mason had been struggling in the weeks leading up to his disappearance, and the note basically confirms this. From what I've gathered from interviews, Mason talked about generally feeling hopeless, and it sounds that maybe he thought his parents didn't love him. And he also apparently said something along the lines of just being sick of it all.
That's not good.
No, it's not. And Tracy, though, was still trying to be optimistic because she looked at that and thought, okay, he's sick of it all. He doesn't think that we love him. Like, that's why he ran away. But Darren looked at the letter and saw a suicide note. And, you know, I can kind of see it both ways. Like, Tracy's point is that it doesn't explicitly say anything about harming himself. And it was hidden, and, you know, most suicide notes are left in the open and meant to be found. But Darren looks at the note, and he sees something that came from a very dark and lonely place, you know, one that's hopeless and not one that's just frustrated and ready to start a new life.
His dad is seeing the dark side because it was written during a depression. You know
right.
what I mean?
Like, yeah.
I'm more apt to side with his mom, kind of along the same lines of what you said, like typically suicide notes are left out in the open
mm-hmm.
to be found to give some sort of explanation. It's not usual that they hide them, especially hide them so well.
Right, right. I mean, it took them a week to find it. So I don't know. And it's tough because Mason has a history of both
running away. And suicide.
Exactly.
Right?
So it's hard to really point in one direction or the other. As the days and weeks go on with no sign of Mason, all avenues are explored. Where they live, St. George, basically looks like a town plopped in the middle of nowhere. There's a ton of open land, of hills and mountains surrounding it. So about 3 weeks after Mason's disappearance, Red Rock Search and Rescue conducts a search of the outskirts of town. Some volunteers are on horseback and others bring cadaver dogs, but they turn up nothing. And it is like, you know, they're out west and I've seen aerial footage in different shows and it's like just a vast space with a bunch of houses in the middle. It's amazing and really daunting, I think, when you're trying to find a person.
It's kind of how I envision all of Utah.
Yeah. To be. Like, I know neither one of us has ever actually been to Utah.
No.
But so we don't really know. But the footage that I saw was just, it looked intense. That's how things basically progress for the next several months. Searches are organized and nothing's found. And while that's certainly frustrating, it allowed Tracy to hold out hope that her son was out there somewhere living his life. She put so much hope in this that she thought there was a good chance he would return in April of 2016.
Why April of 2016?
Because April 7th, 2016 was Mason's 18th birthday.
Ah.
Yeah, so Tracy's theory was that Mason ran away so he wouldn't have to live with her and Darren's rules. But, you know, when he's 18, he's an adult. So he could come back, right? And not have to live under their rules. So she organized an event hoping that it would basically convince Mason that it was safe to come back.
I get where she's coming from, especially in the holding out hope. But, you know, if he ran away, chances are those feelings are still there.
Yeah.
Even though he's legally an adult now, you know?
Yeah. And so April 7th came and went with no sign of the now adult. But regardless, Tracy still clung to the hope that Mason was still out there. And in July of 2016, a tip came in that really made her think that she could be right. Two girls in West Valley, Utah, called the tip line saying that they had seen Mason. And I looked this up. West Valley is about 300 miles north of St. George, and it's right outside of Salt Lake City. And so, like, again, if you're a runaway, I mean, it makes sense to me that you'd want to go to a city, right?
Yeah.
So, like, being outside of Salt Lake kind of makes sense. They said that they not only saw Mason, but they spoke to him. They were inside of a Panda Express, and a young man came up to them and asked if they had any change because he needed bus fare. And the girls remembered the encounter because he was so polite. But then they later put two and two together and realized that the person they encountered looked like the missing Utah teenager. And this is the first solid lead that the Smith family had had in months. So Tracy pounced on it. She met with the girls to get more information, and they mentioned to Tracy that the person they met had a slight speech impediment.
Oh.
Yeah.
That's a big deal.
Oh, it's a huge deal. And so this whole time, Tracy had kept Mason's cell phone active because she was afraid that that was like the only number he had memorized.
I mean, that makes sense.
Yeah. And so she wanted to keep it active in case like he wanted to call home, basically.
Mm-hmm.
And so she had the girls listen to his outgoing voicemail message. And they're like, oh, yeah, that totally sounds like the guy we talked to.
Wow, that's a pretty solid lead. Then.
Exactly. Yeah. So if you're Tracy and you've got nothing for months and these two girls are like, yeah, we saw a guy. He looks like this. You know, he looks like your son. He sounds like your son.
Yeah.
You know,
and then they have a voice to compare it to.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So she's like, oh my gosh, you know, this is it. And so it's just under a year since he went missing. And she's thinking like, okay, like my nightmare's coming to an end. But despite the fact that this sighting gets his case a new wave of publicity, like nothing really comes of it. There's no Mason and no other witnesses come forward saying that they've also seen him.
Someone would assume, again, the local police were contacted and a search was done of the area.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. And like when she had this meeting with the girls, she didn't just like go rogue and do that on her own. I mean, police were involved in that. Now, while Mason's parents were somewhat divided on what had happened to him, with Tracy believing he ran away and Darren believing he probably hurt himself, there was a third option that people outside the family were starting to believe, that Mason's parents did something to him. And, you know, when I say people outside of the family, like, I know you're already looking at me. I'm not just talking about town gossips. Police started to focus their investigations on Darren.
Hmm.
In 2019, the Deseret News reviewed nearly a dozen search warrant affidavits filed by the St. George police in regards to Mason's disappearance. Several of the affidavits say that they're investigating, quote, the crime or crimes of criminal homicide, end quote. In an affidavit that was written on June 21st, 2017, just about 2 years after Mason's disappearance, police wrote, quote, throughout the investigation, there have been discrepancies between what Mason's parents, Tracy and Darren Smith, have told the St. George Police Department, Red Rock Search and Rescue, and the media. These discrepancies all point to the fact that Tracy and Darren know more information surrounding Mason's disappearance than they have disclosed, end quote.
But there's no evidence.
Yeah, no, there's no physical
evidence at the house.
Correct. These search warrant affidavits don't come because, like, they found blood somewhere or anything like that. It's solely based on these perceived discrepancies between what Tracy and Darren have told them, have told the searchers, have told the media, etc. So while they're investigating Darren, police even went so far as to place a GPS tracker on his car for 60 days. Darren had been saying that he was searching for Mason on his own.
Mm-hmm.
And police wanted to keep tabs on him, with the thought being that if he had done something to Mason, there was a chance that he was returning to the scene of the crime.
Sure. I mean, I get that part of
yeah.
it, if that's your theory. I'm just, it seems like a big jump. Again, you know, going from having discrepancies in the stories that they're telling people to either he or they were involved in killing Mason, you know?
Yeah, well, I think, you know, at this point, it's been 2 years. There's been literally no sign of him either way. And so they're thinking, okay, we need to
refocus our
investigation. Yeah, and we need to explore all possibilities. Mm. But getting into it a little bit deeper, as far as discrepancies go, from what I could tell, there were a few main ones. Both Darren and Tracy say they didn't argue with Mason prior to his disappearance, but allegedly the note that was found in his wallet does mention an argument. And again, without having the text of the note, it's hard to say, like, how much of a discrepancy that actually is.
Right, or what the time frame it was of right. the argument versus his disappearance.
Exactly. Another discrepancy is that Darren's initial statement said that he heard Mason leave through the garage, you know, as he thought to get on the bus at 7:40. But Darren checked in at the gym at 7:45, and the gym is 10 minutes from their house.
Okay.
So a little bit of a timeline problem there. Another issue comes from a 2016 warrant in which the lead detective on Mason's case states, quote, neither Tracy nor Darren has ever called me to check on the status of the case since Mason was initially listed as a runaway on 9/1/2015. Over the last year, I have also not heard from any of Mason's siblings regarding the search or status of Mason's case, end quote.
But didn't you say they were active on searching for him themselves?
Well, so that, yeah, I did say that. And this is what's crazy about this next part, this next like supposed discrepancy or you know, piece of evidence. A member of the Red Rock Search and Rescue Group, who is a retired police officer, says that Darren, quote, had specifically told them that he had never seen, heard from Mason on the morning he ran away. In fact, Darren agreed Mason could have gone missing during the night, end quote.
Well, okay, but his statement initially said he woke him up at 7, so he would have seen him.
Well, so no, I don't think he ever actually physically saw him, but like he heard from him because he knocked on the door and was like, hey, are you awake? And, you know, Mason said, yeah, I'm awake. So I don't know that he physically saw him, but he talked to him. So like this whole thing, Darren says like he never said anything like that. I mean, he still says that that Mason went missing that morning, that he talked to Mason that morning, that he heard him downstairs. So he basically says that whole thing is bullshit. It never happened.
Mm.
But, you know, looking from the police perspective, if you take all of this together and then add it to the fact that if violence happens to someone, the perpetrator is usually a family member or someone known to the victim, things, you know, are looking a little bad for Darren Smith.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, and then there's one more thing. Tracy and Darren divorced in 2018. And so armchair detectives have really taken this and run with it. None more so than a man named Bob Odie. Odie, who lives in California, has no connection to the Smith family, but he found himself deeply disturbed by Mason's disappearance. He took it upon himself to get age-progressed photos of Mason, but when he sent them to the Find Mason Smith Facebook page, they declined to distribute them. According to the family, the Smith men couldn't grow beards, so the age-progressed photo showing Mason with a full beard likely wasn't what he actually looked like, so they didn't want to, like, spread that photo around.
Yeah, okay. I mean, I can definitely see that point.
Yeah, and especially because he's, like, some random guy from California, not Nick-Mack.
Exactly, yes.
I think that was the other thing that they were like, this is a little weird.
Yeah. And also getting back to them getting divorced, that's not an indication of any foul play. I mean, they went through something incredibly stressful.
Yeah.
You know, they lost a child.
Right.
So that doesn't seem like it's not that surprising to me that
they got divorced.
Lead to divorce. Yeah.
But to Odie and people, you know, to people like him, they just kind of look at that as like another clue, I guess. So Odie was also put off by the fact that the Facebook page that was set up, you know, for Mason when he went missing allows posts about other missing persons, and that the domains masonsmith.com and masonsarmy.com were available for sale.
These are all very, they don't mean anything to me.
Well, they meant something to him, and he told St. George News, quote, "It just tells me they're not looking. They're not looking at all," end quote.
Just because they may not be the best at maintaining a Facebook page or, you know, a website, that doesn't necessarily mean that they're killers.
Well, but that's the thing. So, and obviously, I don't know what the numbers were when, like, Odie first did this, but as of the last interview that I watched, that Facebook page had like 58,000 members. So it's not like they weren't maintaining it at all. A family friend runs it and she is very active, and they have admins and stuff, and it's a very active page. But yeah, they allow messages about other missing people because they know better than anyone how horrible it is when a family member goes missing. And if they can use their platform to amplify that, like, they're going to do it.
Well, yeah, right.
Right? So, like, that's their thing. They're like, yeah, we do allow posts about other people, like, yeah, for a reason.
Right.
But this whole, like, all of this led Odie to believe that the reason they're not looking is because they know he's not out there to be found. And so he started a blog. So he bought those domains and started a blog and has even put out multiple YouTube videos going over the discrepancies that I mentioned earlier. And, you know, while you may be inclined to write him off as some wackadoo, the police filed for multiple search warrants using basically the same line of thinking. And I'll admit that, you know, when I'm researching this and I first came across the Deseret News article talking about all of these search warrants, like, my crime-addled brain was like, yep, of course, it's the shitty dad who, like, didn't want his nearly adult child watching anime, and they got divorced because she couldn't live with a murderer, like... I mean, that was my initial reaction, just because, like, that is often how these things go. But then, you know, I read a little bit more and I watched an interview from 2019 with Tracy and her brother that is on the blog. So you guys should all watch it. And, you know, I dialed it back a notch. It's a really interesting interview. It's done by a reporter, but it's like a half hour long, unedited conversation.
Mm-hmm.
You really get a good sense of, like, what Tracy and the family have been going through, why she's made the decisions she's made, and just her whole thought process and on all of this, because like I said, it's not edited. So it's just really a very personal conversation.
Yeah. And we've also said this before that, you know, in other cases, you don't know how people are going to react in a situation like this. And you can't judge people by how they react, because
yeah,
everybody's going to react differently.
Yeah. But what's really good about this Deseret News article that I read that talks about all these search warrants is they did a great job about getting the Smith's side of mm-hmm. the story. So what I also found out from that article is that when Darren found out that police suspected him, he immediately demanded to take a polygraph. And again, my official advice is never take a polygraph, but yeah, you know, he told Deseret News, quote, "I called them up because I heard some discrepancies and I sat down with them for 4 hours. And we just went over everything over and over and over again. And I was the one that set that up because I didn't want there to be any discrepancies, any problems. I think I tried really hard to make sure there weren't any inconsistencies," end quote. And then for her part, Tracy says she didn't call the lead detective to get status updates, but she did regularly text and email her. Plus, she kind of figured that if anything big happened, that the detective would reach out to her.
Mm-hmm.
And she also defended her ex-husband, saying, quote, "If he did something to Mason, is he going to go work out that morning? Maybe a sociopath would, but I can attest to you that Darren is not a sociopath. He very much has a conscience, and he's a good dad." And it's just been incredible, the criticism. It's like they're blaming a family that has been traumatized. They haven't found anything. And they can investigate for the rest of our lives. They're not going to find anything or malice in the family, end quote.
I'm more inclined to side with her on this. I don't see them doing this. You know, we've talked about it in other cases. Like, so he's been missing for over 5 years now. Like,
mm-hmm.
so this, you know, suburban Utah dad became like
Genius killer.
Yeah, great at killing somebody and hiding all physical evidence of it being done. Like that just, and then he goes to the gym that morning.
Yeah.
Like, and it doesn't add up to me.
Right.
By all means, police, you know.
I think it's good that they did investigate it because.
Every possible lead, absolutely.
Yeah, you don't want that question hanging out there.
Absolutely.
Right?
Yeah.
And yeah, okay, the timeline for the gym doesn't quite add up.
You're talking about a 10-minute difference.
Well, that's the thing. Like, and that's also assuming that there even is a difference. Like, maybe the clock at the gym was a little bit off.
Right.
Or, you know, Mason actually left 5 minutes earlier than they thought he left. Or something like that. I mean, because it's such a tiny, tiny window of time.
Yeah, exactly.
But the most absurd part of this to me, and we kind of touched on it a little bit earlier, is the allegation that they weren't searching for Mason because there are easily accessible photos and news footage that literally show them in bright yellow t-shirts at the searches. Like, they were there.
Yeah.
And Deseret News like posted some of those photos with the article. Yes. Okay. They weren't out searching, like turning over rocks. Because no one wants the parents to be the one to find him.
Right.
So they...
If it's a body.
Exactly. Yes. And so, and, you know, they took out cadaver dogs early on.
Right.
So they, from the very beginning, thought that there was a good chance that they were looking for a body. And Tracy said in that interview, she's like, they told me not to go out. Like, they set up a trailer for us at the site, like at the kind of home base for the search.
Right.
Again, because nobody wanted them to be the one to find anything. But Tracy said that like she was sitting in that trailer, everybody was searching and she just couldn't handle it anymore. So yeah, she did go home. But, you know, she went home because she was
freaking out.
Yeah. Not yeah, because she didn't care about whether or not they found her son or because he wasn't out there to find or anything like that. She was just going through some shit.
Yeah. And the thought process of, you know, not having the parents find the body is not only, you know, the trauma that it would cause the parents.
Yeah.
But also, if you're a parent and you come across the body of your son, chances are you're going to reach out and start grabbing them.
Exactly. Exactly. And then you're messing with evidence.
Right.
And yeah.
So
but they were there. Like, they were very involved in every single search. So what Tracy believes is that that retired police officer from the Red Rock Search and Rescue, he came in with preconceived notions about what had happened to her son, and he fed that to the St. George police because he's like, you know, I'm one of you. Like, this is what I think. Mm-hmm. And they really took that seriously and kind of went down this other path.
Yeah, or maybe he just misheard something that Darren said.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, but whatever the intentions, it is actually good, like, that they did do all of this because, again, you know, the St. George police, they investigated all avenues and they have said that the Smiths have always been incredibly cooperative and that no one is currently a suspect in Mason's disappearance. So, yes, it sucks because they definitely got dragged through the mud a little bit.
Right.
But ultimately, you know, I think it made the police even more sure that
they cleared them.
Yeah. And as for the divorce, what you said earlier is exactly right. Like, no, Tracy didn't divorce Darren because she was living with a monster who killed their son. Like, they just went through this horrible, horrible tragedy.
Yeah.
And a lot of marriages don't survive that, and it has nothing to do with guilt or any, you know, guilt as in, like, I'm the one who did it.
Yeah.
I'm sure there's plenty of feelings of guilt.
Right. Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And she, again, has nothing but positive things to say about him. Once the investigation into the Smith wound down, one of the search warrants stated, quote, due to the lack of any credible tips and sightings of Mason since his disappearance and the suicide notes found on his laptop and in his room, Mason is probably deceased, end quote. And I should mention, so, like, in addition to that note that they found in his wallet, much later, after his disappearance, they went through his computer and did find a Word document with another note that kind of seemed like a suicide note, but the date it was written was unclear. Hmm. So they're not sure if that's something that had been written right before his disappearance, if it was something that had been written, you know, way before or what. But the point is that there are two notes that at least indicate that Mason had been having suicidal thoughts. And that's where the Smith family is today. On the 5-year anniversary of Mason's disappearance, they had one more large-scale search. This search focused on a 2.5-mile radius around their home because statistically, when someone takes their own life, that's where they do it. When the search turned up nothing, the Smith family decided that they needed to be at peace with their son being gone.
I mean, to me, the strongest lead in this was that he was sighted by those two girls.
That's the one that really kills me about this because, like, that, you're right, that is an incredibly credible lead.
Right.
And that's the main thing that makes me think, oh my gosh, maybe he is out there against all odds. Because it also fits kind of that he was, like, asking for bus fare and things like that, you know? It's so compelling to me.
Why didn't he take money? Why didn't he take his phone or his belongings? I mean, here you have a kid who's has a history of depression, mm-hmm. probably didn't have a plan of what he was going to do, wandered around all day from what it sounds like with the neighbors seeing him, supposedly.
Yeah.
And then maybe he just took off.
Yeah, like maybe it really did start out as him just skipping school.
Right.
Right? Like maybe he didn't, so because it's clear that he did have that planned, right? Because
he hid his
books and everything. So that was definitely planned. That wasn't a spontaneous decision. But maybe that was the plan at first.
Yeah.
That
and maybe as the day progressed, as he was stewing in all of his feelings about everything that had gone on the previous night and the history and of his family, maybe then he decided, you know what? Fuck it, I'm going.
Yeah, maybe.
And he took off. And maybe he's still out there.
I really find that interesting and that it's actually not something that I had thought of when I was researching this. The idea that his plan, that he didn't really have a plan, that he had only kind of planned to skip school, and then whatever happened happened just a little bit more spontaneously. And that really does make that neighbor's sighting make a lot more sense, you know, because like maybe he was walking in his neighborhood around the time that school got out because he was thinking of going home.
Right.
And then decided not to.
Yeah.
But with that said, the ultimate decision still could have been not that he ran away, but that he decided to harm himself.
Yeah.
But if he did run away, it makes sense that he didn't go back home then to get more stuff because his dad wasn't working.
Right.
And so his dad was there in the afternoon.
Right.
Yeah. Like his dad was home when Mason was supposed to get home from school. So there's no way for Mason in the afternoon
to go back in and get
anything,
money or anything, any provisions.
Exactly.
Yeah. I really think that that's probably what happened.
That actually, gosh, that makes a lot of sense. Because to me, I don't know, like, it just seems so weird if he ran away that, you know, he didn't take anything, or if even if he was, like, going to harm himself, it was still weird to me that he, like, didn't take his wallet or anything. I don't know. Like, it just, I just feel like he would have taken something.
Yeah.
But,
or again, left the note out if that.
Yeah, or left the note out. Exactly. Right. Yeah. That there would have just been some indication either way.
Right.
But yeah, if he really didn't have a plan other than to not go to school that day,
then when he's walking back through his neighborhood and he knows his parents are home, or at least his dad is, and he can't get it back into the house mm-hmm. to get anything, then he takes off.
But yeah, like you said, I mean, he is an adult now, and I know Tracy was holding out hope when he was 18, but 22 is a lot different from 18. 5 years is a lot different than one. And, you know, I sincerely hope that, you know, if he is out there, that he really does just make himself known.
Yeah. Just make the phone call.
Mm-hmm. Today, if you visit Crimson Ridge Park in St. George, Utah, you'll see a blue and silver steel bench with a picture of Mason as an anime character, along with his name, his birth date, and the date he went missing. Also on the bench is the inscription, quote, "Never give up, never surrender," end quote. The Smith family is thankful to not only have a physical reminder of their beloved son, but to have a place where others who may be facing the same challenges he had to go sit and remember that they are loved. Mason Darren Smith has been missing since September 1st, 2015. He was 6'4" and 200 pounds. He had blonde hair and was 17 when he went missing. He would be 22 years old today. If you have any information on Mason Smith's whereabouts, please contact the St. George Police at 435-627-4300. You can see all the sources for this episode, along with photos and videos, on our website, andthentheyweregone.com.
And be sure to follow us on social, And Then They Were Gone Pod on Facebook, and at ATTWG Pod on Instagram and Twitter. If you like what we're doing, please subscribe and consider leaving a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts. It will help new listeners find us. And the more people that listen, the more chances we have of bringing someone home.
And we want to hear from you. You can leave us a message at the link in our show notes, and we may play it on a future episode. We'll see you here next week for a brand new episode.
See you next week.
And Then They Were Gone is hosted by Kona Gallagher and Dathan Flick. All research, writing, and editing is done by Kona Gallagher. Theme music is The Stork by Ketsa. Additional music is provided by Kai Engel.
Hey, you can do it!